I have to be careful what I say. He's recording this. My name is Dan. I'm always an alcoholic. You know, no matter how many times I do this, I still get a little nervous at the beginning. You know. I think that's got a lot to do with my gratitude for the program, and I'd like to say something that somebody can use today, you know, something that might keep another person, another alcoholic sober for another day. You know. That's an important part of this, the reason why we do this. It's also giving back, you know, what was freely given to me when I was new. I remember the old timers, and I tried to gather up all the wisdom I could from the old timers listening at meetings. You know, at first I was a really good listener. I listened a lot, and I didn't want to talk. In fact, when they asked me to do a reading, you know, the 12 steps or something like that, I'd say no, I can't do that, because I was never a public speaker. I could never have done this. Before I got through Alcoholics Anonymous, I always kind of stayed within myself, kept my mouth shut, and drank a lot. That's what I did. I'd like to start out by reading something I was reading this morning. I was trying to get some inspiration here, you know, and chapter 3 of the big book, the very first paragraph says, "Most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow someday we will be in control and enjoy the drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death." And when I was reading those this morning, plus my normal readings, I got a little choked up thinking that, you know, wow, this book really has a lot of good information in it to keep a person sober. The problem is a lot of people don't ever pick it up. You know, they'll go to meetings, they'll join the social life of AA. They'll go to the Eaton meetings and stuff, but they never pursue the book enough to get a spiritual awakening, if you will. I don't believe I've ever had a spiritual experience, but I do believe I've had a spiritual awakening. There's a difference. And it's because I've read the big book, I've done the steps, I've done 12-step programs, I've listened to the Joe and Charlie tapes, and I've also done the recently, the Joe McHugh 12-step study guide. And all those things are keeping me sober today, you know. My sobriety date is May 28th, 1990. I came in to the program 4 days without a drink after my second DUI. And they say if you don't remember your last drunk, you haven't had it yet. And I remember it quite vividly, except for the blackout part. In between, in the middle, I had a few hours of nothing, you know. There's something about when the sirens go off and the red light starts flashing in your rearview mirror, it has a tendency to wake you up, you know, from a blackout, and that's what happened to me. I was driving. I'm a drunk driver. I was a drunk driver. And I actually thought there was nothing wrong with that. This is America. It's a free country. What can't you do what you want to do? You know. But I do believe God was looking out for me. Like I said, I've had 2 DUIs and a couple of accidents and things while I was drinking and driving. But luckily, I never hurt anybody. I never even hurt myself. Both of the times that I was arrested, I was just pulled over. And both of the times, they said I was weaving, whatever that means. You know, when you're drunk and you're driving down the road, you think you're going pretty straight, you know. Obviously, I was not. It must have been noticeable, at least. So, I was arrested again. I introduced myself as being always an alcoholic because on page 33 of the big book, it tells you that. That once you're an alcoholic, you're always going to be an alcoholic. There's no way you can go back and drink like a social person, normal person, you know. In fact, I don't know if I ever knew what social drinking was, you know. If somewhere I read that social drinking is like going out with friends only for special occasions and having a drink or two and then going home, you know. Or having a drink at Christmas time or Easter, you know, just to celebrate the holiday. For me, I had a lot of holidays. There was a lot of holidays in my life. It's sunshine and let's go drink, you know. It's raining, let's go drink. It's Tuesday. It didn't take a lot of twisting my arm to get me to go out and have a few. That's what I always said. I'm going out to have a few. Fully aware of the fact that I didn't know what a few was. I didn't count them. And I realized too, toward the end of my drinking, that when I went into a blackout, I continued drinking. You know, whatever the pace was that I was drinking at when I went into a blackout, I'm still drinking. I'm, you know, still standing upright, still functioning, drinking, and I have no idea how many I had or even where I went, you know. I proved that to myself. After my first DUI, I was still drinking. In fact, my youngest sister was taking me to the DUI classes, and then we would go out after the class and have a few and drink. And not that particular time, but on another weekend, I bumped into her at a place where they have a band and dancing and all that. And she came in, and I was already there for a couple hours. And, you know, I realized that the next day that I'd lost a point in time from here to there, something was missing. So I was bold enough, you know, because I wanted to learn about alcoholism. That's what they teach you at the drunk driving school, to learn about it. I don't really think they teach you enough about trying to quit. They just tell you all the specifics, all the facts, all the information, you know. And so I asked her, I said, well, what did we do, you know? She said, oh, we were dancing and drinking, and you were buying me drinks. And then I said, well, then I passed out on the bar, right? You took me home? She said, oh, no. We got into the car. You drove. And we went to another bar and played pool, two games of pool. She said, I won both of them. And a bottle of beer for winning each one. And then we went back, drove back to the bar that I was in first. That's when I passed out at the bar. And she dragged me out. So blackouts scare the hell out of me now. To think about people doing that on a regular basis, that it's completely gone, the memory part of it. And the fact that you continue drinking at the pace you were drinking at while you were still awake, if you will, conscious. When I was new in the program, I thought blackouts and passing out were the same thing. Passing out means that you fall down, you know, or throw up or something. You know, that's passing out to me. And they look at you on the floor and say, well, he's doing all right, he's still breathing. You know, when I was young, a couple of times when I was still experimenting with alcohol, I would go to keg parties. I loved keg parties. They're great. You pay a certain amount to get in the door, and they have food and all that you can drink, you know. And back then it was only like $5, you know, for all night long. And how can you go wrong with that if you're an alcoholic, you know? But one time, I went into a blackout, and they told me, now this is what they told me the next day. When I woke up the next day, I was in my front yard at the house, laying in grass, you know, when the sun was coming up. And I,
what the hell happened?
You know, and so I asked the guys I was drinking with at the party, I said, well, what did I do? He said, well, you went pretty crazy. You started drinking straight booze, and they were raffling off booze bottles, you know, like they like to do. And they said I was climbing a tree. And I slid down the tree. I lost my grip and went like this. So when I woke up in the yard that day, my arms were all scratched up, both sides, and my legs, you know, I was wearing shorts because I went down the tree like this. And don't remember that happening at all. Nothing. So alcoholism can be scary, I think. I grew up on a small farm not too far from where I live now. It's called Fair Plain Road. So if you know where Fair Plain Road is at, it's that ways away. Fair Plain Road goes between Route 5 and Route 20, between Lake City and Fairview, about halfway, you know. We live out in the country there near where Mason's Farm roadside stand is at now. And we owned 15 acres at the time with me growing up. And we did all the work ourselves. We had 5 children in our family, and we did all the work. Most of it, except for picking the grapes. And back then, they used to pick grapes by hand in boxes. You know, you'd hire some people to come in and cut the grapes and throw them in the boxes, and then we would stack them up and put them on the truck. You know, it's a whole lot different now. Now, grape farmers don't ever get off the tractor, you know. I don't think. Different world we live in now. But I learned how to work hard and to play hard, you know. And that's what I believe, you know. If you work hard, you have the right to do what you want to do. And I was a bottle baby. I drank foam off of beer bottles when I was very young. I know I did. And I used to carry the bottles. They used to have brown returnable bottles that my parents used to drink. And I'd be the guy that would carry the empties away and bring back the full ones, you know. And so I grew up with this thought that there's nothing wrong with alcohol drinking. That's what people do for fun, you know. Although I did see some arguments between my mom and my dad, usually about money or something crazy, a bill, or somebody spent money that they weren't supposed to spend, you know, how married arguments go. And they never seemed to argue over their drinking, though. It was always over something else, you know. But whenever it happened, I used to go hide in the closet or run outside if it was summertime. And that's how I got away from the problems. I ran away from my problem. So for pretty much most of my life, that's what I did. You know, I avoided situations, you know. What few fights I've been in my lifetime, I usually lost them, first of all, and because I have no ability or want to be a brawler, you know. So that's how that worked for me, you know. So I started, you know, after I started having my own money, I got a job it's called Beaver Paint Company in Girard, believe it or not. I worked there for about 3.5 years, loading the mills and making paint. And I had no skills, you know. I had a little bit of brawn, but I didn't have any skills. somehow I avoided a draft in the middle 60s, and started working, you know. So my dad insisted that I work. So now I'm working a full-time job and working on the farm, both, you know. Plus I did part-time work for my uncles too. My Uncle Pete was a potato farmer in Fairview, and grew all his own potatoes and sold them to local markets and stuff. And I became a truck loader. Back then, they used to pick potatoes in hampers, we called them, and put them in burlap bags and then stack them on a truck. That's how they did it before they had potato picking machines. And so it was a lot more labor in farming back even when I was young, you know, than it is now. So I started, I got my own money. I started going to Conneaut, Ohio, because where I live, it's only about 12 miles to Conneaut, rather than drive the distance to New York State. You know, when the drinking age was 18 and you could drink 3-2 beer over there, and no one questioned it, or wine, you could drink wine. They sold wine and 3-2 beer in the grocery stores and everywhere, and I thought that was neat. I never realized how those little thoughts accelerate your alcoholism. You know, you think that's really cool. You know, listen to Alita Saturday night, and the guy said, "I met my first wife sitting on a beer case," and that's pretty much how I started dating too. I was looking for the girls in the bars, you know, the pretty girls in the bars, and I'd play pool, and then there was another bar down by the dock in Conneaut. I forgot what the name of that place was called. It didn't matter to me, but they sold hard liquor there too to anybody that had the money. I didn't care, because it was usually late at night when I went there. Well, I learned how to dance drunk. I learned how to drink drunk. drunk, whatever. That was me. And I used to drive home, and sometimes I felt like I was going to pass out, you know, but I still think God had something in mind for me, and probably this is it. This is it. That he never let me go through all that harm and problem, you know, in my early drinking, and kept me from getting hurt so I could be here today. Now, that sounds crazy maybe, but I don't know if I would still be alive today if I would have kept drinking for another 26 years. Because we know that alcoholism is a progressive disease. It always gets worse. It never gets better. And so I started dating. I had a couple of on and off relationships through my early drinking career. And then I met a woman actually in Lake City. She was introduced to me by one of the girls at the bar that I went to. And she had just gotten out of college, and she was, I don't know, that girl thought we would make a good couple. So she gave me her phone number. I called her up, and we went out to dinner, you know. And I started to like her family. You know, you can't love a woman unless you love the family too. That's usually how it works, you know. Her dad was a Canadian mist drinker, and beer, and he loved fishing, and I loved eating fish. He had steak fries in the summer on the grill, and I like steak too. So I fit right in there pretty good. Pretty much controlling my drinking when I was around them, you know. But whenever I went out on my own, or her and I went out, I would drink like an alcoholic, you know. So after 2 years of dating this girl, her name was Suzanne, my brother-in-law pulled me aside one day and he said, "Well, are you going to ask her?" And I said, "What?" Oh, that. So at that point in time, I was, you know, other people around me were settling down too and getting married and things like that. So it's not a good idea. So I asked her, and about 6 months later, we got married, you know, and we had a house built in Lake City on Richardson Drive, and both of us kept working. Oh, at this time, I started working for Irvite Corporation. It's a sheet metal manufacturing shop, and they also sprayed enamel on steel for buildings and pipe and things like that. And I worked there for 32 years. So I was already settled into a full-time job, and she got a job in a bank as a teller. And we started to accumulate some monetary stuff, you know, like the house. We had her car and my car, and we started buying things for the house, you know, new furniture, TV sets and things, and life was good. And we delayed having children for a while because that's what we wanted to do. We wanted to be ready. You know. So when we did decide to have a child, before the child was even born, we had the baby's room all done. You know, everything. Bed, curtains, clothes, you know, everything was ready. And my daughter was born in 1977. July 2nd, 1977. Beautiful little girl. And, you know, then my drinking had the tendency to be bad at times, mostly went after I was bowling. I'm a bowler, I bowled a couple times a week, and there was times when I overdrank, or I was overserved, as Charlie B says, and he was overserved. And I would stumble out of the bar and try to drive home. You know. One time I didn't make it home. I'm sure this was a pass out where I lost consciousness, went off the road, smashed up my truck, the front end, just the front end of it. Didn't hurt myself. And I walked home, and it was in the wintertime. Pretending to do something, I was going to do something about it the next day, you know. And I didn't even tell the wife when I got in that that happened, you know. But the cops came to the door, knocked on the door, and wanted to know what I was going to do about my truck, which was down the road away. And I said, I'm going to leave it there till tomorrow. He said, he insisted, no, you can't leave it there. It's too close to the road. The snowplow is probably going to hit it or something. So I got in the back seat of his car, and we went over there. And at that point, I realized that he's probably going to arrest me for drunk driving. So I ran away. I literally ran away from him, and then started running down the road, heading back toward the house. And he started to follow me on foot at first, and then he turned around and went back to get the car. I went through the woods back to my house because I knew the property around my neighborhood and my house. And when I did that, I realized that, hey, you know, this guy's going to go back to the house and he's going to get me anyway, you know. So I didn't go home. I became a fugitive, I like to call it. You know the movie The Fugitive, where he's running all over the place and they're chasing. That's what I felt like, thank you. And they were chasing me around Lake City, around the different streets and bowling ball. Whenever I saw their flashing lights down there, I went that way, you know. And then when they started getting close, I'd go that way. You know? Hide behind the trees and the cars and stuff so they couldn't see me. It was an amazing thing that I got away with that. I actually ended up running from Lake City to a greenhouse that I worked at part-time. My friend had a greenhouse, and I was going to hide out there overnight, you know, in the winter time. It was too cold in the greenhouse, though. I was wet from here down, from running through the snow with street shoes on, and they never found me that night. I ended up knocking on my dad's door and passing out on his couch until the next day. My wife was furious. he didn't talk to me for a while. What I found out afterwards, when she did start talking again, was that the state police were also looking for me. They had everybody looking for me that night. Nobody found me. And because the next day, I had the car pulled up, I just called the garage, collision garage, to come take it and start working on it. You know, I never went to the scene or anything. And I think it might have had something to do that my brother-in-law was a part-time cop in Girard at the time, that they didn't come in after me the next day, you know. And they knew where I lived. They knew what my vehicle was. Somehow I think he helped me in that respect to not be arrested that time. And there's been other times when I've been almost arrested for drunk and disorderly and drunk on the street, you know. We used to like to go after bowling to Ralphie's in Girard. It's called Ralphie's, but it's Girard Cafe, right in the middle of Girard. And we'd get drunk there and then go over to the Girard Diner and have some breakfast or something and then go home, you know. And in that short walk from Ralphie's over to the diner, I was more than once I was almost arrested for drunk walking. But I always thought that once I got some breakfast in me and a cup of coffee in me, that they wouldn't be able to arrest me, you know. Well, when I got my first DUI, that wasn't true. That's exactly what I did. I went to breakfast, had coffee and bacon and egg, got in my car, and I was driving home, and they still pulled me over. And they said that my headlights weren't on, which is, might have been true, I don't know. But I was still over the limit. It was 0.10 back then. I was barely over, but I was. You know, this was like two hours after I quit drinking. So it shows you I had plenty prior to that. So my first DUI, I went to the Stephanie Dmitrovich, where she just became a new judge then. She's been judge all this time, from the time that I got my arrest until now, 26 years. So after the first one, I did the ARD thing, you know. It's called Accelerated Rehabilitative Disposition. I like to remember that because it reminds me that I'm still a drunk. And what it is they put you on probation. They take your license away for like 60 days and then on probation for 1 year. Under this situation that you're not going to drink and you won't be arrested again. So I agreed to that. I checked a little box on the paper that told me that I was going to agree to these things. Well, like I said before, I went out with my sister drinking afterwards. And after the first DUI, I thought I was just unlucky. Hey, that's probably not going to happen again. You know, I was just in the wrong place at the right time. What I didn't know is that when local and state police arrest a person for DUI, they start tracking you. They know what you drive. They know what your license plate number is. They know where you go, you know, your normal hangout, and they watch you. Even though I knew that, I still thought that, I'll be able to avoid it somehow. Anyhow, the fighting with my wife got worse about my drinking late, and so what did I do? I picked up another bowling night. I was bowling three times a week so I could drink more, and that didn't last too long. She really said, if you don't stop doing that, you're out of here, you know. And I got to the point where I was pretty sure that that was going to happen someday. And guess what? It did. So in 1986, I left my wife and my child. She was about 9 years old at the time. And started my new drinking career. I thought it was going to give me the ability to drink as much as I wanted to, whenever I wanted to. I called that freedom at the time. Freedom to do what I want to do. But I told you, I'd already had one DUI. What did you think was going to happen? What do you think was going to happen? On that uneventful night in 1990, my last drunk, I was at a cake party. Imagine that, drinking booze and beer all day. Things started in the afternoon, and when I went there was like six people there. It went on all day and all night, and that's how long I drank, all day and all night. And I don't remember when I stopped drinking, but I do remember going back to my truck with the intention of sleeping in the truck overnight so that I wouldn't get a DUI. I knew the rules. But the girl I was dancing with came in to my truck and asked me if I was okay because I was slumped over the steering wheel, you know, passed out. And after she started talking to me, I kind of mildly woke up, you know, half-ass woke up, and I think I was going to follow her wherever she was going, like to the restaurant or to her house or whatever, but I put the keys in the ignition and I drove again drunk. And the same thing happened the first time. I was pulled over for weaving. And after the cop realized that I rolled down the window, I think I had a roll down window at the time in an old truck. And he probably could smell the alcohol very easily and asked me to get out of the truck. And when I opened the driver's side door, two or three empty beer cups came rolling out, you know. Obviously, I was drinking beer in the truck, too, and didn't remember doing that. So he asked me to do the field sobriety thing, you know, where you walk the line and you touch your nose and do all that. I said, I can't do that. And he said, why not? And I said, I'm drunk. I can't do that. So I put out my hands and I put the handcuffs on me and actually behind you. And I went off to the state police barracks where I threw up in the wastebasket and got my second DUI. And obviously, I didn't learn anything from the first time or the school or the counseling or all them nasty pictures that they show you at the ARD of automobile accidents with drunk drivers. And what they didn't realize that I'm an alcoholic and I had to drink. That was it at the time. I had to. They had no choice. They say if you're having a problem with drinking, why don't you just stop? Well, I couldn't just stop. It was impossible. Of course, I didn't even really want to stop anyway. I think I wanted the trouble to go away. I wanted the problems to go away. But I didn't want to stop drinking. And when they told me I had to go to AA, that you were going to have to do it eventually anyway, I went right away. I went, like I said, the fourth day after I quit drinking, I went to the Dobbs group, a Thursday night group in Pleasant Ridge Manor, and introduced myself as a visitor. I didn't know the Serenity Prayer. I knew the Our Father at the end, but I didn't know that first prayer. What's that all about? I don't know. So I actually made the determination at that point, though, that alcohol was causing me a problem in my life and I needed to do something about it. And I also knew the rules were that I'm going to go to jail for a while, I'm going to lose my license again. And it was in October of that year, from May, the end of May till first part of June, until October, I went back in front of the judge again, the same one, Dmitrovich, and she wasn't happy, and I don't blame her. So I lost my driver's license for 2 years, two more years of probation. It made life pretty difficult for me at first, you know. But I didn't drink. The old timers said, don't drink no matter what, even if your ass falls off, don't drink. And I did what the old timers told me to do. They said, read the big book. They said, work the steps. Get a sponsor. I got a sponsor about a month after I quit drinking. And he helped me go through the first four steps. I had to get another sponsor later on after about 2 years sober because he stopped going to meetings. And I still thank him for what he did for me to get me started. You know, and my second sponsor took over from there. My sponsor is Nearly Normal Jim, if you know him. He's a really good guy. He's been sober a long time. He likes to hang out in the West County meetings a lot, so you probably won't see him in this way too much. Unless you go to the jail. He goes to the jail meetings. If you end up in jail, you'll probably meet him in there. So, so I had difficulty getting to work. I had to pay people to give me a ride to work. But I started walking. I started walking and riding my bike and to meetings in the evening, so I didn't have to bother anybody. You know, even though people in AA were offering me rides and stuff, I rarely took them. I walked, I rode, I ran. I used to go to the Wednesday night meeting in Fairview in the wintertime when it was snow on the ground. I just put on my tall boots and went for a walk. It was about two and a half miles one way. And it actually gave me a chance to get away. I was living with my dad at the time. I moved back in with my dad while I was regaining my sobriety, if you will. Because his house is on the corner of Fairplane and Middle Road, which is exactly in the middle between Girard, Lake City, and Fairview. It's about 2 or 2.5 miles to all three of them little towns. And I picked all the meetings in those little towns and went to them. I was going to about 5 meetings a week without a driver's license and with no help. And, sometimes my friend Al would give me a ride home after a Saturday meeting, and my aunt and uncle were actually taking me to church on Saturday afternoon. And I started to get back with my own church in St. John's in Girard for a while. And it was kind of nice. We went to dinner, and then they dropped me off at the meeting. But I remember one thing my aunt told me one time. She said, we're not doing this again. I said, what do you mean? She says, if it happens again, we're not doing this again. We're not giving you rides. No, so it was like the end. You know, I had no other choice, I don't believe. This is the right thing to do in God's eyes. The right thing for an alcoholic to do is to quit drinking if you're having a problem with it. And if you think you can mildly drink or have one once in a while, it usually doesn't work that way because you want more. This is a problem with drinking more. We would drink more and more and more because we're searching for that elusive buzz, if you will, or covering up our emotional and problems, you know, that we have in life. You know, a lot of people start drinking because of a death in the family or a lost marriage or whatever. That wasn't true with me. I was drinking my whole life. You know. So when I came in here at age 43, I realized that, you know, I need to keep doing this, you know, or I'm going to end up back in jail again. I knew it. Because I understood at that point what passing out was, what blackouts are, and I knew that I was going to drink and drive again if I drank. So I can't, my mind, my body can't separate drinking and driving. I can't do that. I rarely ever let anybody take my keys unless they stole them from me and told me I couldn't drive. You know? And that was my sister. You know? So now I go to a lot of meetings because I retired in 2010. I actually... my job after 32 years at Irvine APW ended. They closed up the place, and I was without a job for a while in sobriety. And so I signed up for welding retraining at Tri-State Business Institute. It's now called Fortis, and I updated my welding skills, and I got a job at General Electric, believe it or not. So the last 5.5 years of my employment was at General Electric, and I really wasn't doing a lot of welding there either. I took other jobs, and it was great for my retirement. I got a little pension from that, plus my Social Security, and I'm fine with it, you know. 1994, when I was 4 years sober, I bought a house on Fairplane Road, two doors down from where I grew up at. I was out jogging one evening, and there was a for sale sign on the house just on the north side of the railroad tracks there. And I don't know what it was. I thought it was like a gift from God, because that's what I wanted. I wanted to stay there in that area. And so I put a bid in on the job for less money than what they were asking. But there was it was only like four people that bid on it, and mine was the highest bid. So the house needed a lot of work, and that's what I've been doing the last 20 years, working on the house. It's a lot better now. It's got new windows in it, new doors, automatic garage door open. And a lot of landscaping that I do. I was born a farmer, and I still like digging in the dirt, so it's a part of me. And I grow vegetables and give them away to AA people. If you've ever been to the Brown Beggars or some of the meetings I go to, you'll see some of them. And so now that I'm retired, I took over the treasurer's job at the Brown Beggars and got active in that. And plus, I still go to all my evening meetings too. So I'm going to about 10 meetings a week. Not because I have to, because I want to. It's giving back to AA what was given to me. When I first started coming to those meetings in Fairview without a driver's license, there was always somebody there. The door was open, and somebody put the coffee on it. You know? So that's what I try to do today. I try to be responsible in that respect and keeping that stuff going. You know? The Brown Baggers in Fairview have gotten quite successful because we have some food, we have coffee on, and the doors open every day, 6 days a week. And we donate money to the AA causes, and it's working out real well, you know. I'm safely into retirement now, I think. Don't care to be anything more than what I am right now. A recovered alcoholic that have given up the obsession to drink, had it taken away by God, and I feel so comfortable now in my life. You know, that little 9-year-old girl that I had, they ended up moving to Florida. She met her husband in college, and they got married. He joined the Navy. He became an officer. Recently, he was a lieutenant commander. He flew helicopters. He's been in Iraq a couple of times and the Gulf. And lately, he's been doing spy work. What do you call that? Intelligence work in Colorado Springs as a Navy officer. And in November, he's going back to San Diego again, and he's going to